This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
All right. Welcome to this week's episode of Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
All right. We're recording just after the close today, April 21st. It seems like tomorrow it's going to be May, and then it'll be Labor Day before you know it, Sam. So make sure you wear your white while you can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Don't want to hear people grumbling after Labor Day, you know, saying that we didn't warn them. But as we like to say, no white after Labor Day. Or at least as I like to say, I suppose I should throw you into that.
It was, I like to say it just because you like to say it.
All right.
And it does seem like the month or the year is flying by already. You know, I was on a call this morning and I was talking about commodities. I was like, oh yeah, we did a channel 11 on commodities, you know, a couple of years ago. And, you know, we did a webcast on the commodities, Sam, you and I did. And that was, you know, 6 months or so ago. But then I looked and channel 11 was May of last year. So not even a year. And the webcast was 2 months ago, not 6 months ago. So time's going fast, but also slow.
Speeding up for you. I know you've got a kid graduating in a month or so. So it's definitely time has flown. We're not just talking about commodities here, but we're talking about life. So
that's right. Well, it does seem like this week was a long week, even though it was a quiet week. So why don't we get into where are we?
Yeah, part of that long week was probably because we did have our return to the office. So. That was interesting. It was nice to see people there. But in terms of where we are with regards to the market here, the S&P 500 ended the week down 9 basis points. It's almost pretty much flattish, but it does have that negative sign. And in terms of my color code here, it does have a red color to it. So I will say it's negative 9 basis points on a week-to-date basis. Leading the way down, it looks like there were 5 sectors of the underlying the S&P 500 that were in the red, but the biggest losers here were communication services and energy, both down over 2%. On the flip side, we had 3 sectors that did better than 1 percentage point in performance, positive this week: real estate, consumer staples, and utilities. And you know what? I see financials there with up 99 basis points. So I'll give it a participation trophy and lump it in there with the 1% and above positive performers there. Moving over to the fixed income side of things, looks like yields ended up higher across the curve with the 2-year note closing the week at 4.18% yield. That's up 8 basis points in the yield. And the 10-year note ended the week at 3.57. Followed by the bond at 3.77%. That move up in across the treasury curve meant a negative sign in front of the performance for the Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate as well. That was down about 0.25 point on the week. The lone positive performer here within the cohort of the fixed income sectors that we review is bank loans, helped by the floating rate aspect of that particular sector of the fixed income market there. That was up about 10 basis points. But looking across the various sectors here, I see all of them still have a positive sign in front of their performance there. The worst performer is EM, up about 1.5%. Bookended by the best performer on the year so far is the IG corporate credit market, up about 4.5% on the year-to-date basis. But outside of bank loans for the week-to-date performance, everything else was in the red. Agency mortgage-backed securities, on that basis, a relative outperformer, but still down 0.25 point on the week. Treasury is also down just slightly over a quarter point, and then IG corporate's down about 40 basis points for the week there. So every underlying constituent underneath the egg in the red there. Moving over to commodities, commodities are down 2% on the broad index this week, as measured by the Bloomberg Commodity Index. A couple of the standouts that we tend to talk about each week are the WTI crude front month futures that dropped about 6% on the week. So that led to a close below the $80 handle for WTI crude to settle in at $77.80 this week. Let's see. It looks like gold also tumbled below this psychological resistance or psychological level, I'll call it, of $2,000 per troy ounce to settle in the week at $1,980 a troy ounce there. So that dropped by about 1% this week to close below $2,000 again.
Yeah, and on oil, Sam, it seems like it's almost gotten back to the pre-OPEC plus production cut levels. It's given it back pretty quickly. It seems maybe OPEC's going to have to come in through with some more cuts to keep that price above 80.
Yeah, I know once they got into that $60 handle in for per barrel of WTI crude oil, that's when things got a little squishy there. But they did make that announcement right in somewhere was around the mid 70s. So we'll see if that holds true again. But and also another interesting news as we bantered back and forth about the ability of the Department of Energy to refresh the depleted supplies at the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I did see headlines coming out that they are anticipating the ability to purchase and replenish said supplies in the third quarter of this year if the prices of WTI crude oil are accommodative. And for accommodation's sake, we'll say that range in the past that range was $67 to around $72 in terms of the range where the Department of Energy would consider buying WTI crude oil futures there. And then finally, rounding it all out with Bitcoin. Bitcoin was down 10% on the week, still up 65% on the year-to-date basis, but it did close below 30,000 at 27,000 and some change per Bitcoin. So with that, I will hand it back to you, Jeff, to give us a review of what happened in the macro front this week.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. And it was a quiet week on the macro front. We did get on Thursday, so yesterday, no good important data there, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Thursday, we got the jobless claims, which I believe we discussed last week, talking about how to kind of interpret that data. And we did get the numbers out. They came in a little bit higher than expected. The initial jobless claims came in at 245,000, was expected to be 240. Continuing claims came at 1.865 million. It was 40,000 higher than expectation. So a pretty big move there. Again, when we're looking at this, the numbers have increased. If we look at the 4-week moving average of initial claims, is kind of still pretty flat. Continuing claims has risen slightly. Again, something to keep an eye on to see. Something to keep an eye on, but it's also something that the trend is up, and so maybe that's feeding into a little bit of the risk off sentiment that we've seen so far this year or so far this week. We also got the LEI numbers came in on Thursday. That was expected to be down 0.7%, came in down 1.2%. So a big difference there. That means the year-over-year number is down to negative 7.8. And if you look at it historically, looking at the LEI, whenever it gets to this level, we're always in a recession. Every single time you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times, it's been at this level. And not that recession is it's forecasting a recession. You're in a recession at this level. So it's interesting to see that that's at least showing us that, maybe the economy isn't as good as people were thinking. And then on a contrary side of things, this morning we got the S&P Global Manufacturing and Services PMIs. These are the April preliminary numbers, and they both were above 50. The manufacturing came in at 50.4, was expected to be 49. And the services at 53.7 was expected to be 51.5. And this is the first time since June of last year that both numbers have been above 50 at the same time. We'll have to see whether the ISM numbers corroborate this strong data, but interesting to get a little bit of a little bit of a shift there in terms of the PMI numbers. But as Eric Dahl said on the in a chat this morning, the stock market didn't care about these PMI numbers, and so it seems like they're kind of discounting they're discounting these numbers, at least for this week. We move over to Fed speak. Just remember, the Fed blackout starts tomorrow, so it'll be nice, quiet, no Fed speak next week. It was pretty quiet this week. We did get Cleveland Fed President Mester out there anticipated that monetary policy will need to move somewhat further into restrictive territory. Atlanta Fed President Bostic was on, I think it was on TV. He says he favors another hike. And Philly Fed President Harker said that, quote, some additional tightening may be needed. So pretty much par for the course. All Fed presidents that are out there speaking are saying the same thing, that their job is not done. If you look at the WIRP, the interest rate probabilities, we're looking at a 90% probability of a 25 basis point hike on the next Fed meeting on May 3rd. And the year-end number actually is pretty shocking. When I looked at it, it's moved up to 4.58%, and that's a post SVB crisis, that number had moved down to a 4% level. So the market is they've reduced their probability of additional Fed rate cuts later in the year. So now we're at 4.5%. So a pretty big move there. And that's it with the macro update for the week.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Jeff. Let's moving on to the topic of the week. We did receive a question from a listener this week, from Naden there. And Naden's question was around the topic of reverse repo. So I think for those who are wanting to brush up on the policy tool of the reverse repo, they can tune into a previous episode that Jeff and I recorded back on June 4th of 2021. That was the episode 18 of Monday Morning Minute. So that will provide some backdrop here. So we can just go ahead and jump into this conversation of reverse repo to answer Naden's question. And part of Naden's question here was, he had asked, what purpose does it serve for the Fed paying large banks really high rates at the window, which they then pass on to me at 4.5% instead of cash, which was going to be one basis point at his bank there. Relative to the purpose that it used to serve a few years ago when it was first implemented, who is this really helping? And that is just a snippet of a broader question there. So again, this is regarding the window they talk about. This is actually the overnight reverse repo facility at the Fed. And also in that email, Naden had referenced a video of Sheila Bair, who was talking about the reverse repo from the bank's point of view, I would take it, which ultimately led to the question. And Ms. Bair was talking about how the rate differential between what savers got at their commercial banks was so much lower than what they might get in the money fund. So in it, she did make the suggestion and said that the Fed should reduce the overnight reverse repo rate to help banks. Now, for those of you who are listening that have enough track record, and if you remember back to that time, you may recall that Sheila Bair was the head of the FDIC during the global financial crisis, or at least overlapping that period of time. And instrumental from a bank's point of view, especially in the round of bank failures that we saw during that time. So ultimately, one has to think that she's thinking from a commercial bank's point of view. So from that aspect, one should also remember that it's not just reverse repo that's paying a rate that's in excess of the bank's savings rate. Especially if you're just paying out one basis point and you're on your savings deposits there, but money market funds, can also buy T-bills with the rates that today are in the 4% range. I mean, in some cases, you're even getting 5% type handle on T-bills. So if you're willing to dance around that X date for the, in that sense, for the expected deadline for the debt ceiling to be either raised or breached by a certain amount of time. So with that said, it's not really tough to beat the rate that most banks are paying here. And it seems like I might share the same bank because I also get about a basis point on my savings deposit there. So for whatever money I have left there. But All of that changed really the week that included March 8th, which blew up that kind of notion of being able to pay a bank being able to pay below market rates to their depositors. And now if you I took a scan across bankrate.com this morning, and it kind of indicates that most of these smaller banks or regional banks are offering a savings rate to their depositors with a four handle now, while a further scan will also show that these larger money center banks that do participate in open market operations can still afford to pay that one basis point because they get access to that kind of reserve that's inherent within the asset purchase program through open market operations there. So without getting too much of weeds there, the regionals are finally competing with market rates to attract deposits, but in doing so, that's really eating into their net interest margins given the inverted curve. So there was a pretty good racket there, I guess, if you think about it. I mean, today's market, right? You get 4.9%, which is the current rate that you get on interest on reserves. And you were able to fund that at a rate of one basis point to your depositors. So that's a pretty good spread. It's also leads us to question. We've had this conversation a couple of times on the desk about the disincentive for banks to lend under that kind of regime. So as long as you can keep that funding rate low. But that's really the problem that the regional banks are facing today, which, you know, which ultimately, I suppose, led Ms. Bear to be on TV. But getting back to this, the focus on the reverse repo, the purpose of the reverse repo is that it's used as part of monetary policy to help keep the effective funds rate within its targeted range. So as of the March 22nd, 2023 meeting, that was 4.75% Fed funds targeted lower bound. And on the upper bound, that's at 5%. So today, the effective rate at which the federal funds effective rate at which banks lend to one or another on an overnight basis is 4.83. So when we think about the reverse repo rate, it does work in concert with something called the interest on reserve balances. That is also a rate that is set by the Fed, and both of them in tandem are used to help facilitate monetary policy. So along with each FOMC meeting, the Fed sets that Fed funds target range, both the upper and the lower bound. Of late, it's been a difference of 25 basis points. They also set the interest on reserve balances, as well as this overnight reverse repo rate. So again, in March, we had that 4.75 to 5% in terms of the range of the Fed funds rate. On interest on reserves, it was set to 4.9%. And on the reverse repo, they set it to 4.8%. And the latter, these last two rates, you can tell based on what I'm talking about here, they are above the lower bound of the Fed funds target rate, and they typically are, or they are set that way intentionally in order to create this disincentive for banks to lend below the Fed funds rate. So all in all, they're a set of cascading rates with the upper bound of the Fed funds target at the top, followed by a slightly lower interest on reserve balances rate below that. And then that is followed by a lower overnight reverse repo rate. And then finally, you get that lower bound of the Fed funds target range. So the concept here begins with the purpose of, you know, the Fed funds rate. So just as a quick refresher, the Fed funds rate is the rate that banks lend to one another at on an overnight basis to meet minimum reserve requirements. And the idea is that the banks that are eligible to receive interest on reserves won't have this economic incentive to lend at a Fed funds rate to a bank that does need reserves if that Fed funds rate is less than what they can receive from the Fed on their interest on reserve balances. So that in effect creates a floor to which the Fed funds effective rate as a bank with ample reserves really doesn't have that incentive to lend to a bank that does need those reserves if it's at a rate than they could receive by holding by keeping their reserves at the Fed and receiving that interest on reserve balances. So it really just comes down, it boils down to, you know, what's the best use for each dollar that's in a bank's reserve? You know, do they want to take on the interest that they get from the Fed from holding on reserves, or do they want to take on the rate that they can get from lending it to another bank on an overnight basis to help them, that bank, that borrowing bank, with their reserve side of things? On the flip side, the interest on reserve balances, I'm going to call it the IORB. I'm going to throw out that acronym, which is common, I guess, but I wasn't really used to it before this. But the IORB, on the flip side, it also creates a ceiling to keep the Fed funds rate within the or below that upper bound of the range as well. So that ceiling is created when the Fed funds lending rate tracks higher than the IORB. And that's the rationale behind that is banks with ample reserves will now have the incentive to lend at the Fed fund rate as more banks try to go up in that higher Fed funds rate to lend, then that extra supply should, in theory, bring down the Fed's fund rate lower, given that increased supply, again, of willing lenders. So with that, the banks, you know, overall, you know, what I've been talking about with this IORB, that's for banks that are eligible for the to receive interest on their reserves there. But however, since not all banks are eligible to receive interest on reserves, the Fed introduced this notion of the overnight reverse repo policy rate, reverse repurchase rate. And I, the reason why I brought up the interest on reserves first, the IORB, is because the Fed refers to that as its primary policy tool to keep the effective funds rate within its targeted range. So that's the primary mechanism of keeping the rate between the target targeted bounds there. But from there, the overnight reverse repo rate, the Fed calls that its supplemental policy tool. It even goes as far as saying the specific purpose in which it brings it out as being able to create a floor to that Fed funds rate. And it was introduced by the Fed as a way to address those banks that aren't necessarily eligible to receive interest on reserves. And therefore, those banks that can't receive the IORB, they may be willing to lend out at less than that IORB or even less than the Fed funds rate. Because again, it comes back to what's the best use of the reserves. If they can't receive IORB, but they can lend and receive a rate that is in excess of the Fed fund rate, that still works out. But if they can lend and, you know, receive some type of incremental type of yield by going below the Fed funds rate, they probably would do that rather than receive zero. So all of that is to say that if that were possible, then it could pressure the Fed funds rate to trade below that lower bound range. So with the overnight reverse repo, it's there for the banks that can't access that IORB, but still give them an incentive, as I noted, it's at 4.8 versus the 4.75 on the lower bound to kind of support that floor. So again, the overnight reverse repo rate, the purpose of that is intended to be utilized for those banks that still participate in the Fed's fund market, but aren't eligible to receive the interest on reserves. And ultimately, those that are eligible for this reverse repo facility, a la the Fed, include banks, primary dealers, and money market funds there. So that's the long answer. The short answer, Nate, is basically it's there to provide a floor to help facilitate monetary policy, specifically to keep the Fed funds effective rate within that upper and lower bound for both the interest on reserves as well as the Fed's funds, I'm sorry, the overnight reverse repo rate to help facilitate that further. Secondly, there is the next question that he had asked was, since the reverse repo was created for a different purpose, can the Fed close down the facility or put in certain limits? And ultimately, I think we covered the purpose, and I think that purpose still stands to help facilitate the Fed funds effective rate. But theoretically, I suppose you could reduce the maximum limits on how much each counterparty can access all of that overnight facility. And you can also limit the number of counterparties. But if anything, you know, the Fed has done the other way around, Bro, on that by expanding both the maximum limits that each counterparty can access at that window. Or I'm not sure if the window is the right term, but the facility. As well as they've also been increasing the number of counterparties. And, you know, Jeff, I remember when we recorded that first episode on reverse repo back 2 years ago now, just about 2 years ago now. I remember there was so much demand for short dated paper around that time that certain yields on T-bills actually went negative for a brief spell. Yep. And that came from both the increased demand side, but also because of the reduced issuance. So it kind of sounds similar to what's going on today, you know, with the markets that we have there. But one thing is I offer for context today, as of the most recent announcement, a la the March 22nd, 2023 FOMC meeting, they did say that they would conduct standing overnight reverse repurchase agreement operations, they meaning the Fed, at an offering rate of 4.8% with a per counterparty limit of $160 billion per day. And you contrast this versus where it was 2 years ago, March 2021. At that point, the overnight reverse repurchase agreement operations had an offering rate of all of 0.00% and a per counterparty limit of half of what it is today at $80 billion per day. I didn't see a note on the number of counterparties then versus now, but you can see that they certainly have been increasing the reach of the reverse repo facility around this space here. So just kind of bring it all back in the loop, bring it back to this video where, you know, Bear was saying that the Fed should reduce the reverse repo rate. That sounds great for Bear to say, especially, you know, as her role as a former FDIC head, looking to help out the banks there, given this kind of this margin squeeze that they're getting there. But it's really ignoring the aspect that these rates, both the overnight reverse repo tool as well as the IORB are both additional policy tools to maintain that Fed funds effective rate between the range there. So if the Fed were to lower that reverse repo rate, I mean, I guess they could take it down from that current level of 4.8%, but you really don't have much room to go if you want to maintain that floor on the lower bound of 4.75. So a few single digit basis point moves in the Fed overnight reverse repo rate is not really going to move the needle as long as they want to maintain that purpose of using that reverse repo facility to maintain that floor of the effective funds rate that which banks lend to one another. Also, I suppose another way to get a meaningful move would be for the Fed to reduce the lower bound of the Fed funds target rate, which in turn would reduce that overnight reverse repo facility. But that's pretty much antithetical to their current monetary policy objectives from the Fed today.
Yeah, and I think that, Sam, that, you know, if they do limit it or reduce it, then I think you just get a lot of money market funds or government money funds start buying more T-bills, and that drives your short-term T-bill rates down. And especially given where we are in the debt ceiling, doesn't look like there's going to be a lot of T-bill issuance here until that debt ceiling gets resolved. And so that would, you know, tend to drive down very short-term rates. And, you know, that doesn't have a direct effect on Fed funds rate, but certainly they all kind of move in the same general direction. So if you drive down T-bill rates too far, it's the Fed would lose control of that, as you said, that lower bound on the Fed funds rate.
Yeah. And for those of you who, you know, really want to get into the rabbit hole, as I kind of did this morning, if you have some curiosity around that, you can just dig around the Federal Reserve's website as well as the Fed Reserve Bank of New York's website and get some more information on here. But one thing that, you know, I found out is that, you know, when you take a look at the recent lineage of these successive policy tools, you see that they were all born out of the need as a result of our experiment in quantitative easing, which began again in 2008, let's call it. But basically, it was born out of a required mechanism for the Fed to purchase assets, which brought in this concept of this interest on reserves. And that's the thing, interest on reserve balances have gone through a number of name changes. They're just based on the changes that the Fed has implemented. But it first started as just being known as interest on reserves. Ultimately, it became interest on excess reserves, which begat interest on reserve balances, where we stand today as the Fed, you know, phased in required reserves or phased out of required reserves during the pandemic. I don't know if listeners remember that, but that's sometime, I believe, in 2021, that the requirement for reserves was also removed by the Fed during that period to help banks through the, consumers through that period of the pandemic, but they never reintroduced the idea of a required minimum reserve. So that's kind of where we stand on that front. But also within this timeline, going back to the GFC, is this overnight reverse repo facility, where in, I want to say it was September of 2014, the FOMC announced that they would use it to control the Fed funds rate, quote, overnight reverse repo facility is meant to only be used to the extent necessary and will phase out when it is no longer needed to help control the funds rate, end quote. But then you fast forward 7 years or so, and the FOMC released a statement with pretty much just a name change. They had the same purpose, had the same facility, but they changed the name to Standing Overnight Reverse Repo Facility. So the toolbox to kind of keep the quantitative easing genie in the bottle is ever growing, I guess we can say.
Well, you know, like any government program, there's no such thing as a temporary government program.
That's right. That's right. So, Dayton, hopefully you found that useful to your question there. For listeners out there, anyone else that wants to submit a potential topic of the week, feel free to do so. And Jeff and I will turn it around as quickly as we can.
And it doesn't have to be on reverse repo.
That's right. This is our third question on reverse repo. So it's pretty interesting.
With that, let's get to the things to keep an eye on for next week. On Tuesday, we do get the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller 20-city home price indices. If we get another negative print, as is projected, it's projected to be a negative 0.4%. And then that would make 8 consecutive negative prints. And if that happens, the year-over-year number will actually go from 2.55 last month to a negative 0.1%. And that would make it the first time since May of 2012 that we had a negative year-over-year home price. I was going to say home price appreciation, but I guess that would be depreciation. So you get negative home prices there if we get that number. If we move over to Wednesday, we do get durable goods. Those are looking to come in at negative 0.2. It was a negative 0.1 last month. And this will be the first time since the COVID pandemic that we got consecutive negative prints. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. Thursday, as typical, we get the jobless claims numbers. There's no estimate for continuing claims as of right now. Remember, that number was 1.865 million. Initial claims expected to rise 5,000 from 245,000 to 250,000. So continuing that that drift upwards. Thursday, we also get the first GDP estimate. We get, it looks like it's estimated to be a 2.0 flat GDP for the first quarter. The Atlanta Fed GDP now says 2.5, but that will continue to be updated, or it'll actually be updated next Wednesday. So we'll see if that converges with the economist estimate of 2.0, but still positive. So using that as the basis, doesn't look like we're in a recession right now. Unlike the LEI, which is telling us we're in a recession right now. On Friday, we get the employment cost index for the first quarter. That number is expected to be 1.1, up from 1.0 last quarter. This is the number that I believe it was in November, when Powell used this as, or talked about this as one of his things that spooked him. So we'll have to keep an eye on this number to see if it continues to be pretty high, and whether the Fed would continue to raise interest rates. Friday, we also get personal income and personal spending. Income expected to be 0.2, down from 0.3 last month, and spending expected to go negative, a negative 0.1 from a positive 0.2 last month. This would be the weakest income print since April of last year. And we did see spending go negative a couple times last year, in the second half of last year. So I guess a negative 0.1 isn't all that terrible. And then the Fed's, we also get the Fed's preferred inflation gauges here on Friday. We get the PCE deflator. That number is expected to be 0.1, down from 0.3 last month. Because we had a big 1.0 rolling off last year, that actually bring the PCE down to 4.1% from 5. But unfortunately, the core PCE is expected to be 0.3, so flat versus last month. And that actually brings the core PCE from 4.6 to 4.5. So it's another case of where the core number will be higher than the headline number, which, you know, over the past few years hasn't really been the case. But core PCE is the one we care about, the one the Fed cares about. Still at 4.5, a long way to go to get to that 2% Fed funds target level. So we'll have to see how that goes. It looks like the Cleveland Fed inflation now is estimating a 0.35, so it's even higher than the 0.3 that economists are estimating. So we'll just have to see how that how that plays itself out. And that's about it for the things to keep an eye on for next week.
Yeah, it's interesting about, what is it now? About 1.5 years later, I still kind of get chills every time I see this employment cost index come up in the ECO summary, because that November of 2021, I believe, was the one that spooked him, Jeff. And that was kind of the mark, or at least that's when he used that as fodder to kind of announce his pivot, you know, in terms of potentially coming off of low rates. And then of March 2022, he made himself an honest man and began that, embarked upon that that uber aggressive monetary policy tightening. So like I said, it still kind of gives me chills every time I see that ECI come up.
Yeah. I mean, that was, it was definitely something that we really hadn't been monitoring. So to see that come up and something that spooked Powell, you know, all of a sudden that's on our radar now.
Yeah. Yeah. And he really fits the bill of just grabbing whatever data point fits his narrative and just utilizing it. So that kind of began that journey as well, you know, and then subsequently the Michigan sentiment indicators. So, but anyway, yeah, like you said, we tune into what he says, or tune in to see what he's looking at least.
That's right. Especially given the Fed so data dependent these days, we'll have to, you know, keep an eye on what data that Chair Powell likes to use.
But, to use or create, right?
Yeah, Supercore. Yeah. Come on, Supercore, create that now.
All right.
Well, that wraps it up for this week, Sam. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in.
Yeah. Thanks to all of our 10 or so listeners on the Twitter Spaces today that followed us live. But, you know, thanks, of course, to all of our longer term listeners out there who have been following us on the podcast of Monday Morning Minutes. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already, so you don't miss an episode. And for those of you who are listening on the podcast, don't forget you can pick us up each latest episode each Monday before the bell. So for those of you who still perform the podcast platform, we're available on all your favorite ones. If we're not, go ahead and hit us up on email at minutes@doubleline.com, or send us something via the Twitter at DLine Minutes. And of course, you know, send us your comments, you know, your questions or suggestions for topics of the week. So we try to turn them out as quickly as we can once we get the question.
Yep. And don't forget, more information on our website, doubleline.com. YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital. And of course, Sam and Jeff Sherman have their own podcast. It's at Sherman Show Pod there on the Twitter. Hope everyone has a great week, and it's the last week in April.
Yeah, thanks everyone, and good luck out there.
The audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the expressed written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.